John Litcher was Secretary of the Department of Corrections under former governors Tommy Thompson and Scott McCallum. And a few weeks ago, he decided to return as Secretary of the Department of Corrections. John, welcome to Wisconsin Eye, because when you were Secretary of Corrections, there wasn't a Wisconsin Eye, so this is your first appearance. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's good to be here with you, Steve, and I look forward to our conversation, and it's good to be back.
There you were. You were an interim school superintendent, and Governor Walker called you and said, could you return as Secretary of Corrections? Why did you come back to a high-stress job?
Well, I honestly believe that if I could help this administration in relationship to some of the issues that I had been reading about as a retired private citizen, I thought that I would like that challenge. Quite honestly, I think that the Department of Corrections is a complex organization, and it takes time to understand that organization, to understand the culture of the department, and also to understand the issues that come forth in an enterprise such as the Department of Corrections. And so I had that experience, and I thought that could be a benefit to Governor Walker. I thought that could be a benefit to the administration, and hopefully a benefit to the employees of the Department of Corrections. And so understanding my commitment to those employees and the commitment to the employee groups within the department, I agreed to come back, and I'm enjoying my time there.
I'm struck, though, the Department of Corrections that you left in 2002 is much different than the one you walked back into in 2016. Can you talk about some of those major differences, sir?
Well, there are differences in the organizational structure. That's true. I mean, you've gone from a union organization to a non-union organization, and that possibly, from some people's perspective, could be a major change in how you deal with business. But I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that the fact of the matter is that communication is the key. Communication was the key back in 1999 to 2003 when I was there the last time. Communication is still the key today. And how you open up those lines of communication between your workers on the front lines, the correctional officers, the probation and parole agents, the youth counselors, the nurses, the educators that are within the Department of Corrections, and to their management teams is still the critical issue, because they know the issues, they understand them as well as anyone, and we've got to open up their ability to have a dialogue such that their ideas, their solutions, their opinions are, number one, are valued because their positions are valued, and then also because I think they help us become a better management team and we can manage more effectively and efficiently with everybody's ideas and everybody's input.
In 2002, as you said, you ran a unionized DOC. 2016, you do not have that. So the old unionized structure provided ways to resolve discipline and other complaint issues, formal structures to resolve these issues. How do you resolve these? How do you manage DOC in the non-union environment? Now, but my first question is, what about that change, union to non-union? Good change, bad change?
Well, I don't see any issue with the change. I mean, it's a different environment. I respect that comment. But it doesn't have to be good, it doesn't have to be bad. It's, can it work? And it does work, and it can work, and it will continue to work. The key is do you value the work that is being done by the people that you work with? And number one, we do. Do you get their ideas? Do you receive them? Do you solicit them? We are. And do we incorporate them into the solution-making process? And we will, and we are continuing to do that and expanding on that. So it's difficult, or quite honestly, it's impossible for me to put a value judgment on it. What is important is, can you continue to get ideas coming into management and having them part of the solution-based process? And you can do that, and that's why we're outreaching to our employee groups as aggressively as we can. We're trying to build up mechanisms of communication, continued communication, not only with our security staffs, but with all our staffs. And I think that is the key. I think that is the key to making corrections be, as effective as possible, as efficient as possible. And efficiency is a key. And also, and to build on the ideas that I think make corrections good.
One more question on the subject, and then I promise to move on. Under the old system, if a guard had a grievance, he or she would file with their union rep, and it would go up the chain. If a guard has a grievance now, how is that resolved, sir?
Well, there is an internal grievance process. I mean, it's not external in the sense that it's union dominated. It's internal in the sense that we deal with a grievance that comes forth on a work-related grievance. The issue comes into play is at end point. At one time, you possibly would go to a binding arbitration on a grievance process, and now you don't have that as an end process. But the formal aspects of handling any grievance, any issue of concern with an employee, goes into the chain of command as it simply did before. They used to call it steps. Now you can still call it steps. It's just that the ending point is different, but I think you still deal with the issues, you deal with the complaints, you deal with the concerns, and you honestly assess them and try to incorporate the ideas of the worker that brought them forth with the ideas of management, and you deal with it, and you work out the compromise to make it work.
The non-union environment, though, gives more power to the sergeants and the supervisors running the prisons, correct, John?
Well, sergeants always were part of the union base, if you would. The aspect is what we call our supervising officers ones, our supervising officers two, because sergeants and officers are still in the officer class. But those individuals together, and I'll stress this, those individuals together are part of the security base of every institution. They understand that, they respect that, and they understand each other's roles. And I think they deal with the problems on an ongoing basis in an effective manner. And whether you call it a grievance process or some other process, it's communication, it's responding to the concerns of your employees, and dealing with the issues as they come up.
Okay, you've been on the job a few weeks. So how have you launched a tour of some of these facilities, gone to Waupun and Columbia and Thompson and Tichita.
I haven't gone to Tichita. I'm going there Wednesday.
Okay.
I'm going to Tichita and Kettle Moraine. But I've been to Waupun. I've been to Waupun twice. I've been to Columbia. I've been to the secure facility in Boscobel. And I've been to probably over half of the institutions. I think I have maybe five or six left. Two of them I'll be visiting on Wednesday, as I said. The fact of the matter is each time I'm there, I'm reaching out to the employees when I walk through the institutions. Some I have the wardens or deputy wardens who is assisting me with the visit will set up private meetings with myself, with the officer groups, to give them a more ability from their perspective more than mine to be candor and to discuss the issues and concerns that they have in respect to both not only their local institutions, but issues on a broader context. Those have been very valuable to me. Those listening sessions have been extremely positive. And they give me ideas to come back with and say, these are the issues that we have to work on, because they are coming from those individuals that are in the institutions that are dealing with it on a daily basis. Each time I get done with those meetings, I have a debriefing with the warden or the deputy warden to try to understand, these are the comments that are coming to us. These are the comments that we have to face. These are the comments and issues that we have to deal with. And they are dealing with them. To the credit of the wardens, to credit to the security directors, they're open to this. I haven't had any resistance to this, but I've been aggressively pushing this agenda.
Well, Senator Erpenbach has released numbers that were pretty amazing in terms of the staff shortages. I don't have to tell you about that. Some of the vacancy rates at some of your maximum security institutions. Have you been able to, what steps are you going to take? Do you have enough money to hire so guards won't have to come in and work two straight doubles?
We have the money for our posts. I mean, that's given through the budget. The issue is the challenge of the recruitment and the retention. As you know, we put in a pay increase for our correctional officers. It was restricted to those what we would call blue shirts, and that's mm-hmm. the sergeants and our correctional officer groups. That's where the pay was restricted. We gave every officer an 80 cents per hour increase, and we gave those officers at Tichita, Green Bay, Waupun, Columbia, and Lincoln Hills, Copper Lakes, not Tichita, an additional 50 cents per hour, because those were our highest vacancy rate institutions. And we gave that additional 50 cents to try to evaluate, will additional money keep retaining, first of all, the employees that we have, and attract new employees that are coming out of our classes. In respect to the recruitment, we're doing a fairly respectable job there. Our classes, our officer classes are larger. We're getting more people interested in working for corrections. Now we have to put the incentives in place to keep them as they matriculate through their years of experience. And we're looking at that, and we're trying different examples or different ideas, where the pilot of the add-on was one of those ones that we're trying to evaluate. Is it a financial situation? If we get our posts filled, then the idea of overtime will start to dissipate. Even back when I was corrections secretary before, we had an overtime issue, but it was a different issue. More people wanted the overtime because we didn't have quite the vacancy rate, and so people were asking for the overtime. Here it's more on a forced basis, volunteer and or forced basis, and that creates tension. There's no question about it, and we're trying to overcome that. We have been making progress. Our amount of hours and dollars spent on overtime is decreasing each month. I would say even before I stepped in, starting, say, at the beginning of this calendar year in January of 2016, and they have been steadily decreasing. But we're a long ways from being where I would say that you could say you're fully staffed, because you're always going to have probably a 3-4% rotational issue, as most companies do in a vacancy rate. But in our higher agencies, when we started with the add-on, we said any max institution with a higher vacancy rate of 16% is where we put on the add-on to try to attract that. And I think we're going to have some success. I think that we're going to be able to deal with this issue. It's going to take some time. It's not going to be settled overnight. As I tell our staffs, this isn't something that can be solved overnight. But we got to aggressively attract it by better recruiting practices, more local recruiting practices, and you have to deal with the economy. The economy right now gives, and that's good for the state. I mean, we're at a low employment ratio statewide. And so as a result, we're in a competitive environment, and 24/7 operations have to be more, they have to have some incentives to be there, because the stress of a 24/7 operation, the stress of working in corrections on the line, in the cell blocks, those are not easy jobs. Those are not easy jobs.
Why should someone who's in their 20s, who's a graduate of high school, maybe has a year or two in a tech college or a year or two in a UW, why should they come to work as a guard in corrections, and what would be their starting pay, Mr. Secretary?
Starting pay for a new officer coming into our institution after their 8 weeks training is going to be $16 an hour. And first of all, we feel that's a competitive wage. We probably have, and compared to the private sector and other public sectors, we have probably the most extensive and best benefit package that we can offer new family individuals, whether they be male or female, as they come into our institutions. Healthcare, our healthcare package and the payment of an 88-12%, where the state pays 88%, the employee pays 12%, and healthcare is a major issue in both the economy and in our discussion issues as we deal with the private sector. I mean, healthcare is a big issue, and the state has maintained its 88-12% in respect of the state paying 88%, the employee 12%, and our basic benefit package is outstanding. You couple that with the other benefits, whether it's income disability packages, income protection in respect if a disability comes in, the whole retirement issue. We're one of the best states in the union in respect to a fully funded defined benefit package, which private sectors just don't have anymore. It's all 401k, and we have a defined benefit package. You couple our health insurance, our dental, our retirement, our protection and income disability, our life insurance packages, along with our starting pay, that makes an attractive package. That's what you can sell to an employee. That's what we should be selling to our employees, because it's a valued package. It's not just the pay. The pay is important, yes, to a young person. Just as you stated, that pay is important, what I'm getting in my paycheck every 2 weeks. But the total package that the state provides its workers is not only respectable, it goes right it's truly competitive with any market that we're in the field competing with.
Let's look ahead a little bit. You will be shortly preparing, you're probably right now preparing, the 2017-2019 budget. You saw the fiscal note on the fourth OWI as a felony. That said, eventually that could cost your agency more than $100 million. So what are the budget constraints? What are the budget issues as you prepare your next budget, Mr. Secretary?
Well, that's in the deliberative stage right now. I mean, there is nothing established in any kind this is what it's going to be. I mean, I think that those issues are still being evaluated. We're still going through the initial budget process of those initiatives that we want to put forth, both from the capital sector side of improvements on our buildings to what I'd call the initiative side on those type of issues going forth. So as a result, we are still basically dealing with it. But so I don't look at any budget process in the past when I had the privilege before and now as a restriction. It's an opportunity to look at your organization, look inside your entire enterprise and say, what are we doing that we can do better, more efficiently? What are some areas that we shouldn't be doing anymore because it's not necessary? And what are the new areas? You identified one, fourth OWI. But I was on a tour here earlier in May. And so I had a privilege of talking to one of the diversion courts. And within that diversion court area were two judges. So I asked them the question because I was curious. I said, based on a fourth OWI, would you be sentencing anybody with a fourth WI? And they said, not without extenuating circumstances. I think the fourth OWIs will have to have extenuating circumstances before they become, quote unquote, incarcerated. So as a result, I think possibly the fiscal note that was done was possibly too large because they just assumed there that every fourth OWI was going to go to prison. Okay. That is not the case. I don't think that's the case in the county that I asked these two respected judges, and it would be in other judicial branches. The judicial branches understand that it's better to work with the people in the community. So the diversion courts are very, very positive, not only in alcohol and drug treatment issues, but also in drug treatment issues. If you can start to divert people away from the prison system into more community structures, into more community involvement, into more community treatment programs, certainly as a matriculate along this cycle, and they don't, and it isn't connected with a violent accident that has caused bodily harm, and you still deal with it. I think that there will be options within the community that are more effective and certainly more efficient than sending a person to prison.
Are Wisconsin prisons more dangerous in 2016 than they were in 2002 when you last had this job?
I think I don't know if they're more dangerous. I think that. There are more offenders that you have to work with through the programming cycles because programming helps us get over this dangerous concept where if you can get an offender the programming they need, whether that be academic, drug and treatment, anger management, intervention of changing the minds of how they think about dealing with incidents that come upon their lives and deal with those type of issues within a secure environment, and our prisons are secure in that respect, I think the danger aspect has to be evaluated on an institution-by-institution basis. So, no, I wouldn't call them more dangerous, but I think they're more challenging. I think the issues are more challenging. And the needs of the offenders coming in are somewhat heightened. But I don't think that they're more dangerous. Now, some of my colleagues that actually work the lines might disagree with me, and they have the experience. But in my discussions, I haven't heard of that. I have heard of we need the programming to get involved with the inmates and their needs.
There's a number out there that I think people would be interested in. The average cost of caring for an adult male offender in Wisconsin prisons. Is it over $35,000 a year?
In our maxes, it is. Not in our mediums.
Okay.
In our maxes, it's running approximately $37,000 a year.
$37,000
a
year.
It's a little bit over that, but that's in our maxes. Okay. In our maxes. And our mediums run around 33.
Okay. Thank you. Those are numbers that I think are very interesting. Reformers nationally say our prisons, including Wisconsin, include too many inmates convicted of nonviolent crimes who could be safely released. Your thoughts on that, sir?
Well, first of all, we don't assign the sentence. The courts do. And I think that that's an important dichotomy to understand, is that the Department of Corrections doesn't assign a sentence length to the offender and what happened to that offender when he was in or she was in society. The courts do that. We deal with that. We're in a bifurcated system, as you understand. There's the incarcerated supervision, and then there's the community supervision side of it. And that was the truth in sentencing, where the dichotomy, you have so many years here, you have so many years here. So as a result, I think we deal with that in that kind of a way. So we don't sentence individuals. When individuals are sent to us, there are two different ways. They can be, some of programs are called earned release, where if they go through their treatment programs, if they go through the changes that they have to make to come back to society, they do get earned released, and they can be released earlier. I mean, that's the earned release concept. There are many offenders, though, that are sentenced under truth in sentencing that will do their incarcerated time. The idea there, from our perspective, is to give them programming they need, not only as they need it, but as they're getting ready to go into reentry and reintegration back into communities. And I believe sincerely that those programs do work. And in respect to the type of individual they're coming, it's about 65% to 67% of those offenders coming in are in for violent crime. And so as a result, I believe they're sentenced for a reason.
There have been protests in the Capitol repeatedly. There are hundreds of inmates who are still in prison pre-truth in sentencing. And the protesters are saying those should be considered, should be released for probation or parole. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the parole board, as you know, is a separate entity to the Department of Corrections, and they evaluate every inmate under old law that is eligible for parole. And it's my opinion that they do their job judiciously and seriously. They'll look at every offender that comes in front of that parole board. Now, this is my belief. I mean, you'd have to ask the parole chief, with the board and the board itself. But it's my belief, they assess each offender honestly and sincerely. Number one, have they done their program? Were they successful in their programming from the evaluations of those people that they went through? Do they internalize the crime that they perpetuated on the victims, whatever that crime may have been? Are they safe to return to the community? Are there the community resources and the wraparound programs with reentry and reintegration that'll give them a chance for success out in the community once they're released? If all these activities in place, I believe the parole board, because I have met with the parole chief on this issue, I believe the parole board will release those individuals. But if individuals show an uncaring, they don't do their programs, or they refuse programming because they say, I'm not going to do it, I'm going to go to MR, mandatory release date, and that's it. You can't hold me beyond the mandatory release anyway. I'm walking out. Then they are not going to be as inclined to give parole to that offender as they are to those that meet the needs or meet the obligations that they were sentenced for, number one, from a time perspective, and also from a perspective of doing the treatment that they have to have.
Let's talk about solitary confinement. The department, whether it was a result of a lawsuit, I think it was, announced changes in solitary confinement within the last year, prior to you joining. Now, someone who I met with to get ready for this show said, is it true that our average daily solitary confinement used to be 1,400, and has that been cut to 900, 1,400? Down to 900, or are those numbers off the wall?
I don't know. Are you referring to offenders, or are you referring to days?
Offenders.
Oh, okay. In respect to those that are in restrictive housing as we speak?
Yes.
I'm not going to put a number out there in that respect. Let me just simply say is that there is an evaluation on restrictive housing. There's no question about it. We have a complete group of individuals, including treatment people, wardens, and other program specialists that are looking at restrictive housing issues. And what the goal is to reduce the amount of days in restrictive housing of the offenders that are assigned there. Now, certainly we've reduced the time in restrictive housing. We have reduced that dramatically from 2012 to 13 to 14 to 15, which is the last cumulative calendar year that we have. Those numbers have dropped dramatically, both in numbers overall numbers in uh-huh. restrictive housing and the days served in restrictive housing. Why? Because we did adopt what's basically called evidence best practices and evidence-based decision making. And evidence best practices and evidence-based decision making articulate different avenues of dealing with offenders in restrictive housing, instituting step-down programs, which we've instituted in every restrictive housing units, as far as step-down programs where you keep them in a restrictive environment only as long as absolutely necessary based upon the perpetuated crime within the institution that got the offender there, and then they immediately start the process of evaluation for step-down, because the goal is to return them back to general population as soon as possible. I think we're aggressively doing that, and research will tell you that's more effective. And so as a result, on those two areas, another one, in other words, evidence-based practices based upon evidence-based decision-making has reduced restrictive housing usage and restrictive housing time.
Well, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask about this new development yesterday. Now some inmates in solitary are vowing to go on a hunger strike. What's your advice to them?
Well, I think, first of all, my advice to them is, why are they in restrictive housing in the first place? And I would ask them to look at that issue. I mean, there is not individuals picked just for restrictive housing. It's an action by the offender that gets him or her in a restrictive housing. I would simply say that based upon whatever they do, we respond in an appropriate manner. If there is a hunger strike, we'll evaluate it. We'll continue to monitor it. If we think that there's safety issues for the offender himself or herself, in this case, men, we will deal with that on an ongoing basis. And if we'd have to get to the point where we have to go to court for a forced intervention as far as from a feeding perspective, we would. We are basically trying to reduce inmate harm, whether it's self-harm or harm from another offender. And as a result, we will monitor that closely and we'll take the appropriate actions based upon our policies.
Okay, just a few more questions since we're almost out of time. When I look at when Green Bay and Waupun were built, John, their original units were built in the 1800s, I think 1850, 1878 or something. Do you have to, in terms of your capital budget, do you have to begin to phase out those two institutions? Do you have to go to a different structure just because of the aging of our prisons?
Well, I think you look at the utilization of some of our older institutions. You mentioned two, which are the oldest, Waupun and Green Bay. There's no question about that. We've been able to, through use of technology and monitoring, make them secure and safe. As secure and safe as any maximum secure institution is, because both of them are maximum secure institutions. Certainly down the road in the evaluation, I'm sure there will be recommendations brought forward that will deal with just that issue. Have they outlived their life? Is there a more efficient way to deal with the issues of an inmate base in a more modern institution? But those decisions are down the road. Right now, what we're basically doing is keeping those institutions viable through technology, viable through renovation and repair where necessary, viable in the sense of putting valuable programs in there that allow the inmates to get the programming that they need. And they're a very critical part of our overall institutional base right now. And any capital move will take 3 to 5 years to get completed, as the last two institutions I opened along with Governor Thompson at that time mm-hmm. was New Lisbon and Red Granite. I mean, those are basically our two newest institutions, I believe. Hopefully I'm not making a misstatement.
No, I think you're right.
There.
And
as a result, I think you have to look long-term at the capital and changing needs of your institution base, and certainly that would be in the mix. But that is part of the evaluation process we undergo all the time, but I think that's a few years away.
Okay, so you do not, just to be sure I understand, you do not plan to recommend construction of any new prisons in the next biennium?
I'm just saying that those evaluations are being made not only for Green Bay Waupun, but any changes of any institution.
Okay, finally, just two questions on Lincoln Hills. You cannot talk about the investigation, correct?
That's right, because I really don't know any information on the investigation.
Is the investigation holding up any potential changes you might like to make at Lincoln Hills?
No, absolutely not.
And then
absolutely
finally,
not.
Should local counties continue to send their juveniles to Lincoln
Hills? Absolutely.
Why?
Simply because We feel that the changes that we have made at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes and in credit, they started, I think, when the issues were more prevalent than they are now. But the fact of the matter is that the changes we have made in respect to understanding that we're developing a safe and secure environment for those young people. Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes is a school environment. We are meeting those school academic as well as vocational needs of those students. We have made changes with monitoring the complaint process such that the youthful offender, the young adult that's there has a sense of security that if he or she makes a complaint, it will be viewed by a third-party complaint investigator along with the superintendent such that if it's viable, we'll take immediate action to try to change whatever that problem is. Our goal, and I think we've reached that goal, but we are continuing evaluation process and ongoing, a safe and secure environment for the offenders, a respectable and responsible academic program, meeting the mental health and also the physical health needs of these offenders, dealing with the reentry and reintegration, and dealing with the community groups to assist us with that, such that when they go back as a person with hope and with a person that has the ability to reintegrate successfully. The fact of the matter is that the counties will have to make their decisions based on how they make their decisions. But we have made Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes, and we continue to make those improvements. It's not a static environment. It's a dynamic environment where those ongoing improvements have to be continued. Our monitoring has to be ongoing. Our weekly investigation of each incident report from both a superintendent staff at the local institution, but also from the management staff at the department level is ongoing such that we know what is happening and we believe sincerely that it is the right environment for the individuals that need a secure environment for a short period of time. Most of those offenders will be returning back to the streets. They're 15 or 16 years old. They'll be returning back shortly. We have an obligation to meet their needs. We have an obligation to meet their education, academic needs. We have an obligation to meet their mental health needs. And we have an obligation to keep them safe and secure.
And this is my final question. You'll be a successful secretary 3 years from now when we do this interview if?
If, number one, we can open lines of communication with our working staff. If we can continue to improve our evidence-based practices and implementing those within the Department of Corrections. And if we understand that part of our charge is to develop a safe and secure environment, whether that be for our juveniles and for our offenders, and in continuing with the improvement on reentry and reintegration. The ultimate goal for all of corrections is to reintegrate those offenders, to have a reentry program that allows them to be successful. Because if we do that, you have less revocations, you have less revocations with new crime, and you have successful people entering both society and entering the workforce. So we have academic programs that have to do their jobs, we have vocational programs, we have to integrate them back with the jobs within our society. That's how I'll evaluate whether I'm successful. And we now have data that's able to track that type of situation, which we didn't have 12 years ago. Our research is much better. We have a whole area devoted to research, and we will have those numbers. And then I'll be able to say whether I'll be successful or not.
Secretary of Corrections John Litcher, welcome back to State Government. Welcome to Wisconsinite. Thanks for this conversation.
Thanks, Steve. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, very good.